So anyway, a friend of mine was saying, "Listen, you have to try and understand. This is you can't this talk about leniency for guys like David Edelstein. This is completely not allowed to say this kind of thing. It's it's probably in her mind the equivalent of somebody saying the N-word way poor Viggo Mortensen did and making that mistake. There's certain phrases, certain attitudes." That just are not permitted, and they find it heinous and repulsive, and they will not tolerate it. So I guess my basic thing was I think he was an idiot for saying that. I think it was he shouldn't have been cavalier about something like this, particularly given what was bandied about 2 years ago. I mean, even though there really wasn't as traumatic as it all seems to have been, given that. As again, Maria Schneider is completely clear about the fact that when they were making the film Last Tango in Paris, it was all simulated. Nobody was actually having intercourse or anything, and the whole thing that had happened was basically she wasn't consulted. They weren't very considerate to her before they filmed the scene because they wanted her to be surprised by something. And I don't think that was very fair. And Bertolucci felt he wanted to see get her to react, not as an actress, but as a woman who felt surprised and upset. So that's I understand anyone agreeing with Maria Schneider. But basically, my point to my friend was, apart from your justified revulsion at a crass, unfeeling. Lighthearted joke about something like this. Do we really have to assassinate people immediately? Do their heads have to come off immediately when they do this? Why is it such severe justice that we're talking about? Why is it immediately this man needs to be killed? That's it. He's got to be taken outside and shot. And that's it. I mean, his life is over. And I wonder, where's the sense of proportion? Where's the it just doesn't seem right to murder somebody in a manner of speaking, if they
Then the New York Post's film critic Sarah Stewart, she replied. She said, maybe David should have just read the room, and it wasn't the time for that joke. And I replied, I understand that. The joke was stupid. It was dumb. But, fair that the guy loses his job over a dumb joke?
Yeah, I think that I think what people probably had in mind is what I would have in mind is caning or being spanked or being put on probation for a couple of weeks, maybe month, something like that, but not assassination, I guess.
I know. Anyway, let's go back to the New York Film
Yeah,
Critics Circle,
sure.
because that is why we are doing this.
Yeah.
Because the Edelstein thing can be a whole podcast in itself,
Yeah,
really.
yeah.
But I'm happy Paul Schrader won for best screenplay and Ethan Hawke won for best actor. That was great.
I was delighted. I mean, I that was exactly how I would have voted, and I was, and the echo that I got out of it was that the people that are on Gold Derby, that I am one of the Gold Derby people, been saying all along, why is it that there's a myself and there's a guy from ESPN who also has Ethan Hawke listed, and they all don't have him, and there's one reason for that, and only one reason, which is that they will not look or consider a would-be a contender for this or that acting award if the film they're in came out before Labor Day. They just won't touch it, and it's really offensive. I mean, if this were the year of, let's say, The Silence of the Lambs, which was 90 or 91,
91.
or whatever that was, and maybe 90, that, as we all know, came out in February. If there was a gold derby or something like that, does that mean it would have been blown off also? It wound up winning Best Picture, and obviously Hopkins won, you know, Best Actor. So.
I think the Silence of the Lambs Valentine's Day release was in 1991, and I think it was the kind of film that changed the industry a lot. It was a groundbreaker,
yeah.
And people just remembered it all throughout that year. Mm-hmm. But you get so many films that are released around the spring between January and March that just get lost in the shuffle. The mm-hmm. one of the best examples that I always mention is Wonder Boys, which was released in March, and I remember them trying to re-release it in November.
Mm-hmm.
That film,
right?
It happens all the time.
Yeah,
but I think Ethan Hawke has gotten such a boost.
Yeah,
the last week.
Mm-hmm.
That he has to be mentioned now in the actor conversation.
I mean, at the very least, as I was saying the other day, at the very least, he should have that fifth slot, because the other four, I think, are probably taken. Do you agree about the fifth slot?
Well, there's Christian Bale for Vice. There's Bradley Cooper for Star is Born.
Right.
You need Viggo in there for Green Book.
Yep.
And then Rami Malek for Bohemian Rhapsody, which is being really universally praised by normal audiences and Academy voters.
Yeah.
I would presume that he gets that fifth slot. I can't see anyone else really taking it from him.
Yeah.
You know anyone else that could take it? I mean, there's Hugh Jackman kind of stalled, even though I find he deserves it. That movie is just dead now.
It hasn't taken off. I guess people feel that it's too too much of a kind of a tragedy. It's too glum. It ends with his defeat and his and the country heading in the wrong place, if you will. I get that.
I guess Willem Dafoe as well.
You know, that's true. He was really wonderful in that. I just felt that the movie's not a magnificent film. It's a good film.
Mm-hmm.
But I really thought Dafoe was so intimately involved with that personality, with that Van Gogh trip, that depressive thing that poor guy had in his life.
Yeah.
I thought, I really believed it, and I felt it was really... I mean, if that were to happen, you know, he's kind of, I guess, in people's minds, they allow the idea of maybe one person from the indie sector to have a Best Actor slot. Ryan Gosling's not going to happen, I don't think. That's over, too, because of the general sense that the that First Man was a disappointment to a lot of people, I guess.
Which is strange, because the reviews were universally positive.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just think general audiences just didn't really care for it. But I was going to mention Gosling. I think he's the only obstacle for that fifth nominee for Ethan Hawke. I think it's safe to say Ethan Hawke will get nominated.
You think what? I'm sorry.
I think Ethan Hawke will get nominated.
Oh, okay. You think that this cinches it? The two awards in a row, Gotham and New York Film Critics.
Well, who's going to take that fifth slot if it's not him?
Yeah.
It's been a weak year for acting, for male acting.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
I can't really see anyone else taking it.
Let's hope. I mean, they. The conversation people. I mean, remember, it used to be that there were two conversational groups that voted for these things. One was the Gurus, and the other is the Gold Derby. I'm not really. I know that Ray Pride has kind of reanimated Movie City News, but I don't know what that Gurus of Gold is really happening. Is it? I mean, I last time I looked, I guess. You ever look, have you? Did you look at the new Movie City News? I mean, it's pretty much.
I went. Yeah, I went on it, and there's still stuff written on the front page from March.
Okay.
They haven't really updated it fully.
Wait, I should. No, let's take this back. There is a Gurus of Gold going. There really is. It was posted as of November 23rd. That's Ray, I guess, doing that. And and it has the David Edelstein thing on the front. Let me see.
But you still have David Poland stuff from June.
Okay.
On the front.
All right.
I think they're slowly getting the site updated. They need to change a few things, but it's slowly moving towards the right direction.
Right.
Well, but back to Hawk, I think I think he's going to be the critical darling for actors. And that's going to push him for the fifth slot, if not, you know, he might even be top four at the end of award season. Because right now, if you look at L.A. is coming up, the L.A. Film Critics and other film critics.
Is this weekend?
I believe so.
It's usually on a Sunday.
Yeah, I just can't see him giving the actor awards to audience-friendly films like A Star Is Born or Green Book. It will be between Christian Bale and Ethan Hawke from now till the end of award season as far as the high-end film critic awards go.
Right.
Yeah, I see it that way. So I think Ethan Hawke is in very good position right now.
Yeah. Okay. So what's the latest that you hear? Switching over to another topic, about screenings, if any. I haven't heard about any for critics for the Mule, the Clint Eastwood film. They're being awfully standoffish about that. It seems.
I have not gotten a single invite to a screening. I don't think anyone's gotten an invite to a screening for that.
Yeah.
Eastwood seems to have finished post-production. He was editing it in the summer. I know that.
Yeah.
I don't know. They're keeping it very hush-hush when it comes to that movie. Have you heard anything about possible upcoming press screenings?
A friend at the during the Fox Searchlight party wrote the Warner Brothers person, and he's on pretty good terms with them. And they said, we'll be getting back to you soon about that. They don't have anything set, but I believe that there is a guild screening or something for one of the non-press groups, and they're seeing it on the 7th or something like that in December. So that's not too long from now. Pretty soon from now.
Critics top 10 lists are coming out starting next week.
Yeah.
I mean, I know Eric Cohn already posted his today.
Mm-hmm.
Usually around December 7th is when the big high profile critics start to release their top 10s, and clearly Clint Eastwood's Mule might not make the cutoff date for those. So,
well, they said from the beginning it's not really an Oscar or award season movie. It's just a good movie. So maybe she just.
That still looks very dark.
Yeah, it's about a guy who's basically at the end of his rope and no money, and forced into doing. Oh, look. Let's just take a look at the best movies of 18 according to Eric Cohn. That's a topic we can get into. I can see that one of his nominees, one of his favorites for best movie, is Support the Girls. So there's one person who voted for Regina Hall, big time, because he was not just about Regina, but the movie itself. which is interesting.
Yeah, actually, if you go on the IndieWire page,
yeah,
a news that just broke is that,
yeah,
is that Christian Bale had a heart attack while filming Vice.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. He suffered a heart attack shortly after principal photography finished on the Dick Cheney biographical drama. And I quote, McKay said, while I was making the movie, I was fairly conscious of the fact that I put on some weight. I was smoking a lot. My doctor told me, you've got to stop doing this. And I kept saying, please don't let me have a heart attack while I'm doing a movie about Dick Cheney. Anyway, I'll be reading the full finish.
Well, when you...
it happened during a workout with his trainer where he got tingly hands and his stomach started going queasy. I mean, you know, this up and down... the yo-yoing.
Not healthy. Not healthy. It's not good for you.
Not healthy at all.
Yeah.
And this is coming from someone. I was a personal trainer and in the fitness industry for close to 10 years. So yeah. I know exactly how dangerous it is to yo-yo the way Christian Bale has yo-yoed throughout his career for the sole purpose of method acting. Anyway, this is not good. He should stop doing that.
I should stop doing it? What do you mean?
He should stop.
Oh, he should stop doing it. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, not you. Mm. Not you. No, no, you're fine. Mm. But he should really stop going up and down in weight because this is drastic weight changing. Yeah. This is going 50, 100 pounds up and down, up and down. Right. Your heart can only... so much of that, and he's still pretty young too. He's not even 50.
Yeah. Let's review, shall we? Let's just review for the fun of it. Eric's top 18 films of the year. His number 18 is Paddington 2, which a lot of people liked. Did you see that? And what did you feel about that? Would you put it on a list of your own?
I put it in my top 20, probably. It's a very fun picture to watch.
Yeah.
The CGI animation is great. I'm actually surprised that it didn't win animation at the New York Film Critics Awards earlier today.
Yeah, yeah.
Spider-Man Into the Verse won it, which I haven't seen.
Now, the next one that he has here is number 17, is Vox Lux, which I have right here as a file, and I've been too stupidly lazy to simply sit down and watch it. I've got a really nice setup here where I can mirror my films and watch it on the 65-inch, and I still haven't seen it. Have you seen it?
I have. You're going to hate it. I hated it.
Okay.
Well, the word hate is a little too harsh.
Okay.
I thought Natalie Portman's performance was not as good as the initial buzz told us.
All right.
I thought it was very pretentious filmmaking with excellent set pieces here and there. First scene of the film is fantastic. The last scene of the film is fantastic, but there are such abrupt tempo changes in this movie that it's completely mind-boggling. They decided to randomly switch the film in the middle. Anyway, you'll see. There's an abrupt change in setting. It goes 20 years later, just like that.
Right.
The character development isn't as strong as I wanted it to be. But Natalie Portman as well. I'm not sure she can get a Best Actress nomination for this.
Eric's number 16 is the one that we saw together at Sundance last year, which is We the Animals, which I thought was actually pretty good. I was very taken with that film. I love the imaginative, that Terry Malick feeling, that, you know, the surreal flying sequences, the metaphor of basically what a creative person is like. They kind of live in their head, and they do the drawings, and, you know, they're not entirely of the world. I thought it was great. Kind of liked it. Really did.
Yeah, we went to see it after we read Eric Cohn's review, which compared it as this year's Moonlight.
Yeah.
it should really
No. The in fact, I thought the kid being into guys, into boys, was so like okay, that's fine. But I didn't see it as central to who he was or what his story was. I thought it was about his color, his book, his drawings, his imagination, his, you know, the way he, you know, he had the head of an artist, and that was the thing, not his sexuality. But that was me.
Which is great, yeah. The director basically was trying to insinuate, fine, he has these feelings for men, but that really isn't what I'm trying to tell you. This isn't the story I'm trying to tell.
Yeah.
Which can be said for number 15 on his list, Can You Ever Forgive Me? That's the same thing.
Yeah.
Well, Melissa McCarthy is her Lee Israel is a lesbian, but the movie doesn't really care that much about that. It cares more about her story, and which is really just outrageous but highly entertaining.
All right. 14 is Border, which I never even saw. Have you seen that?
Yeah, it's good. It's a fairy tale troll love story.
Yeah.
I saw it at Cannes. It does delve into gender bending and identity politics, but in very subtle ways again. It's visionary. It has one of the weirdest sex scenes I've ever seen. definitely not a turn on to watch that sex scene.
Support the Girls, we already talked about. The next one on Eric's list, number 12, is Mandy, which I did see, finally. I went to pay to see it at the IFC Center. Really think it was overpraised. I think it's, you know, it's just kind of a generic Nick Cage freaks out and does his crazy guy shtick, which is enjoyable, but I didn't think it was that good, honestly. I wrote a whole thing about it, why I thought it was not. But I thought it was way overpraised by the people that like edgy horror films, and I didn't agree with the consensus at all on that. I know that a lot of people were saying, you got to see Mandy. You know, this is something that is essential. Your 2018 viewing year will be incomplete if you don't see it. Well, I saw it.
With a heavy goth metal soundtrack that overwhelms.
And then his number 11 is Poor Widows, and I say Poor Widows because it has taken on the aura of a film that didn't connect. And if you look at the cinema score and the ratings on Rotten Tomatoes from not critics now, but critics loved it, but average folks, IMDb, it hasn't done all that well, and it's obviously not doing too well commercially.
I told you last week when we did the podcast.
Yeah.
You know, people are coming up to me. They're like, Jordan, why the rave for Widows? It's not that good. You know, it's I liked it. I gave it a B+. I know you liked it more.
Yeah.
But people are just not warming up to this movie, and it is a very hard movie to warm up to because also it's being sold as a heist thriller, which it really isn't.
Yeah, it's not really about the mechanics of a heist. It's really more about the, the various participants and their worries and their concerns, their angst, you know, the things that are like on their backs, giving them a heavy heart. So it's a good film, though. I thought it was a real immersion into that realm of Chicago and the different economic strata, all that. So
I love Steve McQueen, so I've loved every single one of his movies, and he's just the visual master, and he shows it here again. But by even making high art out of the Gillian Flynn novel.
Yeah. I'm very speaking of New York film critics. I was terrified that they were going to go for Beale Street. And they didn't, and that's, I'm not trying to root for the failure of the film, I respected it as far as it went, but I didn't think it was anything that was, it certainly wasn't as interesting to me as Moonlight. And what were your feeling about Beale Street, basically?
I had the same feelings as you about Beale Street. And in fact, it was I who told you that it was a Wong Kar-wai ripoff.
Yeah.
Just like Moonlight was, but Moonlight at least had an interesting story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Beale Street is very lovey-dovey. You know, it's meant to be romantic. It's meant to be about injustice and the really highly unfair judicial system in the United States, but it never penetrated. It never absorbed quite like Moonlight did for me.
I was there. I mean, I respect Barry's decision to stick very faithfully to James Baldwin's 1974 novel, but the sense is that you watch any film about anybody going through a difficult situation is that you want to see some sense of justice prevail, even if it's negative justice, like the bad guy or the person with a problem is having to face his or her shortcomings, or you know, some kind of thing where God's eye prevails and the truth of it prevails. It didn't feel that way. It's not. I find it fundamentally unsatisfying to see that poor guy, the poor young husband, taking a deal where he's going to be in jail for 20 years for something he didn't do, and they try to. You know, the mom, played by Regina Hall, does what she can to try and change the testimony of the woman in Puerto Rico who put him in jail in the first place. And things don't work out. And I respect that's the idea. I mean, we're trying to say things are, the deck is stacked against people of color back in the 70s and today. But it still doesn't feel satisfying. And I didn't like it at all for that. I didn't find, I felt empty and pissed off at the end.
But we've seen this story before, too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yes, he tells this story in a very different kind of way in a narrative that does recall Wong Kar-wai's cinema.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I never felt fully invested in the characters and their plight. And also, you know, I just can't see audiences, you know, connecting to this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Already this fall, First Man, Widows, Green Book, Boy Erased, Can You Ever Forgive Me? People bombed.
Yeah.
So, how can you expect a film like Beale Street to perform well when those more audience-friendly movies...
It's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen. Critics are going to push it as much as they possibly can, and we all know critics have jumped on the Beale Street bandwagon, but it's not
going to
happen.
See, Madeline's Madeline. You know, this sounds like I'm you know, here I am, this derelict person who's supposed to see everything. I haven't seen that either because I didn't want to see it. I take it you have, Res. You caught it, right?
Yeah, it's not that impressive. It's a New York hipster thing. A lot of the folks that I've spoken to really felt cold and distant from that film.
Yeah.
But New York film critics seem to really like Josephine Decker, who is the director of this movie, and you know, it's her meta statement on you know, indistinguishable fantasy. It's baffling. It's really well shot, but it just felt incoherent and not really that good. Mm-hmm. I bet you're going to be bored.
I wasn't at all bored by Burning, by the way. That is a movie that gets better and better the more I think about it. I was definitely inclined to say, yeah, that was a good film. That was a good complex film. But it gets stronger the more I think about it. I kind of want to see it again just for the enjoyment aspect alone. I really like the. I didn't care, and I would never will care for the main protagonist, who's the young writer, who's didn't strike me as a writer at all. He said struck me as a very slow, almost dim-witted fellow who just doesn't seem to have much intellectual energy, or you know, he's not very judgmental. He's not very. He sort of kind of sits there with his mouth open throughout the whole film. I won't say what happened at the end, but he, you know, it was unsatisfying with that. But otherwise, I was fascinated by that creepy rich guy character, Ben, played by Stephen Yeun. You pronounce it Y-E-U-N. The guy with the Porsche, you know, the guy with all the money. And he was fascinating. He was like Bruno Antony in Strangers on a Train or something. He was really...
I thought all three of the main characters were fascinating, and that comparison to Bruno on Strangers is dead on, really. It's definitely one of my favorite movies this year, and it's such a fascinating whodunit.
Yeah,
where you don't really know what was done and who did it. Film, it just leaves you in total mystery, but you're just hypnotized by what's happening. It's a very hypnotic experience. So number six is Private Life.
It's an okay film. It's intriguing. I love Kaylee Carter. I came out of that saying she is a fine. I mean, I want to keep seeing her in a lot of other things. I mean, I fully thumbs up on her, but the idea of they're trying to conceive and they need to, you know, resort to a niece to help be a surrogate mom, and then it doesn't work out, and they're going to keep trying at the end. It wasn't a very satisfying ending,
it hit home for me because I do have a family member that was going through what they went through. So in terms of that, I did find the experience very personal to me. And it is a universal thing. It does happen to many people. The hurdle and the frustration of trying to get pregnant. I interviewed the whole cast for this movie, and... yeah, I was particularly taken by Kaylee Carter, who really just is the heart of this movie.
And of course, Sorry to Bother You was very highly praised by a lot of people when it was first seen at, I think it was Sundance, right? Wasn't that it?
Yeah.
And I didn't catch it then, but I finally caught it last summer. And I like the you know, it was kind of reminded me of Britannia Hospital with the surreal, the animals, people being turned into animals, and I kind of got it. I mean, I wasn't knocked out by it. I just thought it was, okay, interesting. You know, David Cross is cool, and I like that. I like that voice that Lakeith Stanfield had. And, you know, I laughed. I don't know. I wouldn't put it this high unless I put it that way. He's got his fifth best film of 2018. I don't. You know, Eric is. He can have peculiar tastes. No offense.
Yeah. But it's his own taste, and that's why I do respect Eric Cohn. He really doesn't follow the grain as much as other critics do. But kudos to him for.
And, of course, First Reformed is his fourth bit, which I agree with. Death of Stalin, we've both seen that. That was a pretty effective comedy, and I liked, I've always liked Armando Iannucci's tone and everything. I didn't think it was as good as his others. I thought it was, it's got a focus and a discipline, and it was darkly funny, but it was never ha-ha funny.
I agree with you. I agree. I'm a big fan of Veep, HBO's Veep, which is the mastermind.
Yeah.
And I was a big fan of In the Loop. Death of Stalin is the weaker of the three, I find. It still has some very funny moments, and it does take a very dark turn, which was totally unexpected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it wouldn't make my top 20, but it's good. It's a good movie.
And of course, Roma's is number two, which we probably both agree with. And then number one is Favorite, which I agree with it being up on near the top or within the top 10. But I do not agree with how it, we've said this before, but it does not have a satisfying third act. You can't, whatever your film is up to in terms of pacing and tone and attitude and everything, a film has to pivot. It has to double down, has to strengthen, deepen the game that it's playing. And this movie did not change or pivot or anything. It just stayed on the same level. And someone told me two nights ago, oh, that ending, though, the ending with the rabbits, that was really something. I didn't find it something. I found it, it's not a satisfying film in the last third. I just got tired of it.
I love that final shot. We're going to have to agree to disagree on Favorite, which to me would definitely be up there.
Yeah.
For my favorite of the year. But I'm actually surprised you didn't have You Were Never Really Here, which I remember talking to Eric about it, and he was really... I think it was him. He really liked it.
Yeah.
But that's a film that is definitely a highlight for me this year.
Yeah, yeah. So besides the Eastwood, and by the way, have you seen Mary Poppins yet?
I'm watching that tonight at 6 p.m.
Okay.
Have you?
Nope. I didn't want to stay in town. I was feeling a little weathered, so I went back, and I figure I'm going to catch it on December 10th, I think it is, or 9th,
okay.
Or something like that.
What's the general word of mouth about Mary Poppins?
Well, one of my critic friends, who's part of the New York Film Critics Circle, said I was surprised. I was surprised that after about 10 or 15 minutes, I succumbed. And there's not a big negative thing at all. I mean, people were, surprised that they liked it as much as they did.
I think a lot of people are underestimating its chances at Best Picture.
Oh, come on. Because, really? Is that what you're hearing?
Here's the thing. I think it's going to be a hit. There's been a lot of artistic achievements that have bombed at the box office.
Mm-hmm.
The Oscars want some ratings.
Yeah.
The only box office success right now is A Star Is Born, and I guess if it gets nominated, Black Panther, which it will. Mary Poppins is going to be big. I think it's going to be very big, and I've heard a few people that saw it that really liked it.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, is it high art? No, of course not. But the way Oscar pundit thinking is going, you know, you can leave the room open now for a Mary Poppins. It's very strange.
You know, it's like the political map. There's two different realms that this country. There's the Fox News red state realm, the Trump supporter realm, and then there is the sensible people on the blue state who think that the Fox News realm is ridiculous, and they can't even talk to them, much less talk about. The movie thing is basically, the people don't want to know from critics' favorites. They're saying to themselves, well, maybe I might see it, but I'll see it on Amazon or Netflix or Hulu Plus, and I'm not going to pay to see it for, I'm not going to spend $50 to see it.
And yeah.
Los Angeles, that's what it costs. It costs almost $20 per ticket, or $18, plus parking, plus everything else, and it's a different kind of expenditure.
And which is why a movie like Bohemian Rhapsody, which is really connecting with with audiences and yeah. just normal Joe Popcorn people does have a chance.
Yeah.
It does have a chance. And did you read Sasha's piece today? It was really, really interesting.
She waited until now to review Bohemian Rhapsody?
No. She had a piece called Can Bohemian Rhapsody Defy Critics and Earn a Best Picture Nomination?
Oh, I see. Okay.
She makes a good point.
Okay.
I mean, I think critics were way off on this movie.
Mm.
Did they already have a bias against it going in? I think they did. Bryan Singer directed the movie.
Yeah, that's a fair thing to say, that people didn't particularly want it to be a big hit because they don't like the idea of praising a film that a person who's been regarded as a sexual abuser, or at least been portrayed that way in the press, once again, another way of opportunity to reference the fact that Esquire never wrote that story about him.
Right. Which I've been asking around, and nobody really has an answer why it was never published. Mm. Mm. But I have my theories.
Right.
You know, Singer probably lawyered up. Fox. Mm.
Yeah.
20th Century probably lawyered up. Right. Everyone was ready.
Yeah.
They were on the attack.
Mm-hmm.
But I liked Bohemian Rhapsody, and I think it succeeds in doing what it sets out to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
yeah.
But then again, its success will now have Hollywood execs greenlighting left and right rock star biopics.
Yeah.
So,
swear to God, I'm not going to be happy. I cannot be happy with the way Elton John sounds in the forthcoming Rocket Man. He just, the guy who they've got, I don't know who's doing the singing exactly. Is it Taron Egerton or is it somebody else? I don't know who it is. But it's not quite right, you know.
If it's not Egerton, they should have just chosen, taken Elton John's voice. And,
very simple. He's part of the film. He's an exec producer on it. I mean, why they would do it, it's crazy, you know.
Elton John is one of the most recorded artists of all time. There are so many concerts of his that have been bootlegged and recorded and officially released.
Mm-hmm.
They could have just used that audio for even the live performances, but no, they decided to probably give it to Taron Egerton to sing.
It sounds like it might be him. Who knows? But I know that for Bohemian Rhapsody, the voice that we're hearing, the Freddie Mercury voice that we're hearing, is a combination of Freddie himself, a guy they hired who's a good Freddie impersonator, and Rami Malek and his own voice to some extent. But
they
somehow blended, right?
Yeah, maybe they should have done that. You know, it's not too late for them to change Elton's voice in the movie. I mean,
it's not. You know, they could easily, they could easily do the thing that, because I really when I heard the sing, I said, well, that's somebody that kind of sounds like him, but not really.
Yeah.
So why are we listening to somebody who doesn't sound like him? Not really.
That's another movie that has a openly gay musician.
Mm-hmm.
It will be interesting to see how they tackle his identity crisis in the movie, because Elton was once married to a woman.
Yeah.
Just like Freddie Mercury was.
Yeah, same basic thing.
I would hope that they would tackle, you know.
Mm.
It's gonna be interesting. There will surely be think pieces about about the way his sexuality is depicted, as there always are now.
And like Freddie, Elton John is shown as a guy with problems as far as coke and whatnot is concerned. So we'll see how that plays out.
Yeah, Elton had major problems.
Yeah.
I think his problems were far worse than Freddie's. I think he even contemplated suicide. And he was a huge cokehead in the 70s.
Yeah, I imagine. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, it's a very outrageous life that he had. It's a very over the top life, kind of akin to Liberace's life. So. I presume the Elton John story will be more entertaining than Freddie Mercury's, which, at least based on Bohemian Rhapsody, was not as flamboyant as you know, the history books have claimed.
Yeah. Okay, well let's talk again next week then. What are you doing? You're going to, as you said, you're going to see. Mary Poppins tonight. I'm going to go to a screening of Moral Roman, probably my last big screening. And on Saturday, there's a going to the Bill Goldman Memorial in Manhattan in the afternoon, and then there's a Warner Brothers party at 5 up on at a bar on Amsterdam Avenue, and then at 7:30 or 8, I think I'm going to be seeing the Kenneth Lonergan play called Waverly Gallery.
Yeah, I really want to watch that that play. I didn't know that that it was already playing.
It was in previews, and I think it went into regular performances a little while ago, maybe 3 weeks ago, something like that.
60 Minutes had a thing on Aaron Sorkin's To Kill a Mockingbird this weekend, which is opening, I think, this week, or has already opened.
Yeah, I'd like to see that, too. I mean, as long as I'm a temporary New Yorker, I'd like to see that. But it's expensive, and I don't think I can get any freebies. It's really quite the hit on your pocketbook to see a play these days.
Yeah.
Not even a musical.
I'm going to be catching Vice next week, finally. I'm really excited to see it because, right, you know, I'm just totally immersed into these kind of politics, and Dick Cheney is such a fascinating, bewildering, evil person.
He's not a very conflicted guy, and that's the thing. And he's very droll, and I think there's a great moment, which I will not spoil for you, but there's a great moment where Cheney finally turns to the camera, breaks the fourth wall, and explains his basic attitude about responding to 9/11 and about the Iraq War and everything else.
And I heard about that. It takes place halfway, right? Halfway through the picture?
The fourth wall breaking that I'm talking about happens at the very end, actually.
Oh, okay. Great.
Yeah.
I look forward to it.
Yeah.
Would that crack your top 10?
Yeah, actually. Yeah. I was delighted. I mean, I was really, I mean, Chris Tapley wrote that he was, geez, bums you out, and wow, I don't know if anybody's going to want to see this with all the horrors of Donald Trump every day staring at them from their phones and whether, well, I don't know. This movie is not a glum ride at all. It's an exciting, smart, very, very, at times, very funny film, in a dark way, of course. But it's certainly entertaining, in my idea of entertaining, anyway. So
I never got that. Film critics complaining that a film bums them out too much.
Yeah.
You know, art is not supposed to always make you feel good or make you happy.
There's nothing about this movie that can leave you in a depressed place. It's a sobering film. It certainly doesn't.
Yeah.
It certainly says to the audience watching it, all you people who voted for Bush Cheney, you know, this is on you. I'm sorry, but you know, it wasn't exactly a complex thing to see what happened back then. They ignored the warnings about 9/11. And then they sold themselves to the security moms as, we're the ones you want to stick with now that we're in a war. It was amazing what they did, but they got away with it. You know,
it's very interesting how now an interesting phenomenon has happened where Trump supporters are basically Trump haters, are basically Bush haters.
Mm-hmm.
It would be very hard to find a Trump voter that likes George W. Bush. the party has completely disowned him, which is an interesting phenomenon.
Yeah.
It goes to show just how disastrous that presidency was.
I'm very heartened. The last thing I'll say is that 3 days ago, or was it 4 days ago, Beto O'Rourke basically changed his tune, and he said, you know, we'll see. But I'm he's basically going to run. He decided he's not going to say anymore that I'm, you know, that I'm not going to do it. He's going to do it, and I think that if anybody's going to beat him, it's going to be a guy who's 35 years younger, and 2 inches taller. And a hell of a lot smarter. I think that Trump, that alpha male, that big, burly, pot-bellied alpha male thing, you know, people see strength in that somehow. And I'll probably get killed for saying something, you know, unflattering to the idea of a woman candidate. But I love the idea of a smart woman president. I want to see it happen. But I think that Beto O'Rourke has a better shot of beating him. And I also think that because he's a younger guy and he skateboards and he was in a band in the 90s, I just think it's going to get people who are younger to vote for him.
Yeah, but he's gonna have to contend against Hillary Clinton probably, which she shouldn't even run. But that's another.
That's appalling. You think she's actually going to try and go in? She's lost twice. It's over. Forget it. You know, I mean, whatever you're going to do with the rest of your life, do it. But don't even think about trying to run for president. And she's going to?
I think that rumor is legitimate because a few of her old advisors have confirmed that it might very well happen. So
I think that average Democratic voters are just appalled that she would even think of doing this.
I know, but she, you know, the Democratic Party owes her a lot of money too, and they wouldn't stop her from running.
It's a bad thing to put out, you know. The people I know that she technically won, obviously the popular vote, but she's, you know, it's bad form. I mean, if you lost twice, you lost twice. You know, there's life. Yeah. You know, I wouldn't even think about it if I were her. But she's.
I mean, she just would look like a sore loser trying to. Go for a third time.
Yeah, and egoistic, you know, not able to keep herself in check, it seems.
Right. A lot of ego goes into that mindset.
Yeah.